Whenever the Dalai Lama, the spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhism, comes to the West, his trips are fraught with political implications.
That's because China, which claims Tibet as part of its territory, is especially sensitive to Western leaders greeting the Dalai Lama as a political leader.
So when he met last week with President Obama, the White House was careful to describe it as a meeting with a religious leader. But that didn't stop China from lashing out at a man that they've called a wolf in monk's robes and warning of possible negative consequences, suggesting a spring meeting with the Chinese premier could be canceled.
Now, part of what exiled Tibetans are asking for is what the Dalai Lama calls the middle way. That's a measure of political autonomy and greater protection for Tibet's culture and religion. Yesterday afternoon in Los Angeles, the Dalai Lama spoke to thousands of admirers about what he calls the Buddhist way.
He was the guest of a group called Whole Child International, which works with orphanages to foster more nurturing environments for institutionalized children. It's something the Dalai Lama has experience with, though in his case, the institution was a grand palace outside Tibet's traditional capital, Lhasa. When I joined him, he sat cross-legged on a chair, arranged his saffron robes around him, and leaned back, happy to share some memories from his childhood. You were enthroned when you were 4 years old, away from your family, your mother and your father for most of the time. And while you were attended to and revered, in a way your story sounds almost like a childhood spent without parents. But I know your mother was very close to you. And I'm wondering, because I think people don't quite realize that she was even there. What was she able to give to you?
I came to Central Tibet at the age of four. My mother not live with mother together, but daytime my mother always used to come. Some month I live in Portola Palace. Then my mother live, in town. So
in Lhasa.
Yes, big distance. But occasionally my mother come. But however, my childhood, like another child, I love play. I very much reluctant for study. Only play. No other sort of children, but elder people, including those sweepers.
The sweepers, like the people who are sweeping outside the palace?
Yes. Mm. And also gardener. Of course, they put me on throne. Or high seat. But beside that, they play with me very equally. Sometimes they want to defeat me.
Defeated in like a game?
Yes. Sometimes even I cry.
And this playtime with the workers around the palace who treated him like they might have their own children gave the young Dalai Lama, he says, a sense of the home that he had lost. And he laughed that losing at games also taught him a key tenet of Buddhism, humility. From his mother, he learned a different lesson. This peasant woman, elevated to the mother of a holy being, as he remembers it, always shone brightly as a beacon of compassion. Her first impulse was to help anyone in need. Do you think you would have been a different person in the world if your childhood had had less love and affection? Do you think you would be different?
That I don't know. Of course, generally speaking, the affection at a young age, compassionate atmosphere, is very, very essential. Of course, my family, my mother, a religious, had no education, illiterate, but very kind. Very, very kind mother to anybody. So thus I feel fortunate. Very, very fortunate. The seed of that compassion come from my mother. There's no question.
Tibetans in northwest China this past week, near where you were born, set off fireworks to celebrate your visit with President Obama. How much is the future of Tibet riding on a meeting like that?
Of course, initially, they little bit sort of excited, and they're not only Tibetan, but also number of white Chinese also, I think, feel happy. Then, of course, official level, in spite of what is their real feeling, Chinese government. They have to express negatively.
which they did. They expressed a great deal of negativity. When the president was making his first official presidential visit to China last fall, he did not meet with you in a visit where he could have. At the time, you said publicly that you supported his decision.
Yes. I know his thinking. Naturally, if before that meeting, if our meeting take place, then Chinese may accuse. So they deliberately postponed, and he can engage more effectively.
With China.
That's our thinking.
And of course, in January, under some pressure from the Obama administration, China resumed talks with representatives of Tibet.
Yes, that means our contact still continue. I think my own case, my daily life, almost 90% spent on spiritual field.
Spiritual.
And that promotion of religious harmony the rest of my life, till my death.
At you're 74 going on 75. Yes. And I gather that you are openly talking about the succession, the 15th Dalai Lama, whoever he or she might be.
Yes.
There are fears that China would choose its own candidate. What would be your preference of how this comes about?
Ultimately, up to people. I made it clear whether this very institution should continue or not.
The very institution of the Dalai Lama.
Yes. If majority of Tibetan people feel the Dalai Lama institution is no longer much relevant, then this institution will cease. There's no problem. It looks as the Chinese more concerned about this institution than me.
Of course, at this moment in history, the majority of the Tibetan people have made it clear they very much do want the institution of the Dalai Lama to continue, which is likely to keep the man revered by millions as His Holiness traveling the world for some time to come. The 14th Dalai Lama spoke to us here in Los Angeles.
Let's stay on Capitol Hill for a moment to visit a townhouse that's getting a lot of attention. It's the Washington residence of several members of Congress who are fundamentalist Christians. The secretive C Street Center, which owns it, claims status as a church. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
133 C Street Southeast sits a half block from one of the House office buildings, roughly three blocks from the Capitol. As with other religious organizations, the IRS takes the C Street Center's word that it's a church. That means the center doesn't have to file public tax returns the way most nonprofit organizations do. It's an arrangement that fits the C Street Center's practically invisible public presence. But now a group of 13 ministers has asked the IRS to revoke that church status. Eric Williams leads the effort. He's pastor of the North Congregational United Church of Christ in Columbus, Ohio. He says the C Street townhouse mainly seems to provide room and board to members of Congress.
Is there public worship? Is it open to the public? Are there trained leaders who serve the church? C Street really has none of those marks that make it a church.
And if that's the case, Williams says it opens up other questions about whether the C Street Center is doing things that violate the rules of 501c3 charities. We couldn't call the center for an interview yesterday because it doesn't reveal its phone number or numbers for lawyers or other contacts on public documents or elsewhere. The townhouse would likely go unnoticed, except that its denizens keep popping up in embarrassing news stories. South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford lived there when he was a Republican member of the House. Last June, he got caught going to visit his mistress in Buenos Aires. Sanford held a tearful press conference where he said he'd turned back to C Street for help.
I was part of a group called C Street when I was in Washington. It was a, believe it or not, a Christian Bible study of some folks that asked of members of Congress hard questions that I think were very, very important, and I've been working with them.
Then, 3 weeks after that, the wife of Mississippi Republican Chip Pickering filed an alienation of affections lawsuit against Pickering's mistress. She alleged that they carried on a home-wrecking affair while he was in Congress and living at C Street. And then, in November, two Republican senators drew still more publicity to C Street. Nevada Senator John Ensign owned up to an affair with a staffer, and Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma said he had been a go-between as Ensign and the woman's husband fought over a financial settlement. Here's Coburn on the ABC program this week.
Look, my whole goal in this thing was to bring two families to a closure of a very painful episode.
The vast majority of lawmakers who stay at C Street are Republicans, but regardless of party, they are all followers of an intimate, high-powered, and some say closed, Christian network. They belong to House and Senate prayer groups at the Capitol. Those groups are organized by the Fellowship Foundation, a $19 million entity that builds alliances of leaders led by God, as it said on a 2005 federal tax return. The Fellowship Foundation also organizes the annual National Prayer Breakfast, where every president since Dwight Eisenhower has spoken. As recently as 2006, the Fellowship Foundation's tax return listed the C Street Center as a related organization. But Foundation President Richard Carver draws a bright line between the Fellowship and C Street.
There are members of Congress there who may very well be a part of the prayer groups in the House and Senate.
But that's as far as he'll go.
The Fellowship Foundation has never owned the C Street facility. The C Street facility has its own board of directors who set their own policies. And we have no operational control over what happens at C Street, to the best of my knowledge.
Carver says he's only been to the C Street townhouse one time, and that was 6 years ago. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
Elsewhere on the radio dial today, a leading Christian broadcaster is making a transition. That's the music announcing Focus on the Family, broadcast by James Dobson for three decades. Now he's leaving the show and the organization he founded.
The Lord has led us. He's put his hand in my back, and it's been very clear that he's saying, it's time to go. It's time to let go.
The people who've listened over the years include Dan Gilgoff, who wrote a book about the religious right. Dobson was a loud voice among conservatives, though he didn't speak loudly on the show.
Dobson comes along and he's, you know, this licensed therapist that talks about really emotional issues. You know, he'll let tape roll with a grown man breaking down on air talking about dealing with alcoholism. He just kind of provided something of a sanctuary on the dial for family advice, and I think millions of his listeners developed a relationship with him, a rather intimate one, on their drive to work or over their lunch break.
Dobson leaves the program today, though he will start another with his son. The change suggests an evolution in the Christian right. Why is Dobson leaving Focus on the Family?
Dobson is leaving, he says, because organizations that are founded by charismatic leaders often make the mistake of keeping those leaders around for way too long. And so once that leader exits the scene, and Dobson himself now is approaching his mid-70s, the organization undergoes an identity crisis and in some cases hard-pressed to survive.
What is the organization without him?
That's yet to be seen. Right now, they have about 860 staffers, and it's important to note that that's down from a high of around 1,400 staffers. So they've been hard hit by the economy out there, and they've also been hit by a failure so far to appeal to a new generation of Christian listeners out there. Focus on the Family's main pipeline into the country is Dobson's daily radio show. And the average age of the listener now is about 50 years old. And for an organization that's built around promoting healthy families and appealing to 20 and 30-year-olds, that's a problem.
And at the same time, you mentioned the radio show. Dobson says he's leaving Focus on the Family, but he's not leaving radio.
He's not. He's joining his son to host a new radio show that's going to be called James Dobson on the Family. You know, it's anticipated that this will be competitive with Focus on the Family's current radio programming.
Well, is he telling the truth then, or the whole truth, that this is really all about making sure that Focus on the Family can continue?
Well, I think some of it is about that. But I also think that it signals his desire to get a lot more political. What's ironic about that, though, is because Dobson's appeal to his radio listeners was never primarily political, it was always family-based. He's a psychologist dispensing advice on, you know, raising healthy families. The more political he got, the more he kind of scared off listeners that were coming to him for family advice. And so at this point, he really wants to take it more in a political direction. And I think it raises questions as to how, you know, relevant he'll continue to be, because that was never his primary selling point.
And the organization Focus on the Family Without Him is becoming a little less political, isn't it?
It is. Dobson was the classic culture warrior, and his replacement, Jim Daly, is someone who's much more in the conciliatory mode of someone like Rick Warren, who on the campaign trail in 2008 hosted the only forum where the Democratic and Republican presidential nominees actually sat down together. So it's that model of conversation and kind of talking to one another, dialogue, that the new face of Focus seems to represent.
You know, you wrote a book called The Jesus Machine, and the subtitle of that was How James Dobson, Focus on the Family, and Evangelical America Are Winning the Culture War. Is there still a culture war, and are they still winning?
I think, much to everyone's surprise, the answer is yes and yes. On the one hand, we've elected a very socially liberal president in Barack Obama. On the other hand, you know, an issue like abortion was one of those that has at least temporarily sidetracked healthcare reform. So I think the culture war rages on, and the right, I think, is clearly still winning.
Does that mean the right has not been defeated? They're not in retreat here. They're just retrenching and changing their tactics a little bit. And that's what we're seeing in the reshuffling of Focus on the Family and James Dobson.
I think some of it is that, but some of it, I think, is more sincere than that. Evangelicals have been sensitive to the way they've been branded in the media in recent years, and some are upset with how closely they've been associated with confrontational culture warriors like James Dobson. For instance, every time you talk to Rick Warren, he goes out of his way to emphasize that he is not a Christian right leader, never was, and doesn't want to be.
Dan Gilgoff of CNN, thanks very much.
Steve, thanks for having me.